You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. There is so much in the news today that it's mind-boggling. I start out with, one of the regulars on this program, one of our regular conservatives that we go to is Neil McCabe. He's the editor of the Guns and Patriots Powerful Conservative Voices newsletter. And he just wrote a piece trashing Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney is presenting himself now to the Republican Party as an electable Republican. Jeb Bush is sort of doing the same. And, of course, you got Chris Christie saying, yeah, I'm electable. I got a few scandals. You got Rick Scott maybe saying, Rick Perry is running for Congress so bad it's like his tongue is hanging out. You know, he's drooling. He's trashing President Obama. Oh, Obama's coming to Texas, but he's not going to go to the border. And I'm not going to show up and shake his hand. I would have a private meeting with him, however. Yeah, right. Like, you're running for president. You want the president of the United States to give you some more airtime? Is that the deal? It was so interesting this morning. I got up Louise and I were putting together the radio show and the TV show to the extent that, throwing stories, ideas out for our morning meetings with our staff and our producers and whatnot. And finally, I went out to the living room a salon in a boat. To the living room, but it's attached to the kitchen, so it's all kind of one little room, and the dining room. And turned on the TV, and it was the end of MSNBC's Morning Joe, and what's-his-name comes on, Chuck Todd. And it was like, he starts out with a Republican congressman, and then he starts talking about Ted Cruz, and then he goes to some other Republican, and then it was... the first half hour or so was all I could stand. I finally turned it off. It was Republican talking point after Republican talking point after Republican talking point. It just kind of blew my mind. But I guess that's Chuck Todd's thing these days. In any case, the idea of Mitt Romney going up against Ted Cruz, I find fascinating. There's a bunch of other things here that I want to talk about today that we're going to get into. Piece in the Financial Times, the headline, Bankers Warn Over Rising U.S. Business Lending. I have to explain what that means, but basically it's more, we live in a bubble, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. Get ready. Number one. Number two, I mentioned this yesterday, I never got around to it. The SWAT teams in Massachusetts say you can't do public record requests on what we're up to. And they're using a piece of law to get around this that's pretty startling. And there's a piece in the New York Times titled "The Risk of Hospital Mergers," and it talks about basically how incredibly destructive it is. It doesn't say this in the Times piece, but if you know the backstory, you get it. How destructive it is that in 1982-83, Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. And no president has enforced it since. And that's why there's no downtown in America that looks, in most of small town America, that looks like anything other than Applebee's and McDonald's, national chains, and Macy's and whatever, and Walmart. But anyhow, Romney versus Cruz. Romney, and we did a number of programs on this back during the election of 2012, when Romney was running against Obama, how this white horse prophecy is a big deal in the Mormon Church. It's not actually part of the Book of Mormon. It was about a speech that Joseph Smith gave in May of 1843, and. It's published in the Mormons. A lot of more. It's not part of official doctrine, but it is. A number of Mormons called into the program and said, oh, yeah, they talk about this in our church on Sundays. And everybody knows about the White Horse Prophecy. And the White Horse Prophecy talks about you will go to the Rocky Mountains and you will see a great and mighty people established, which I will call the White Horse of Peace and Safety. Your enemies will follow you with persecutions and make obnoxious laws against you in Congress to destroy the white horse. And they did. They outlawed polygamy. But you will have a friend or two. And then you will see the Constitution of the United States almost destroyed. It will hang by a thread, and that thread is fine as the finest silk fiber. Now, a lot of people feel that we're at that point right now. Constitution's under attack. Some, you know, from the right, some from the left. I mean, you know, it's, and it will be preserved and saved by the efforts of the white horse and the red horse, who will combine in its defense. And the time will come when the banks in every nation will fail. A terrible revolution will take place in Atlanta, in America, excuse me. The land will be literally left without a supreme government. England and France are now bitter enemies. Keep in mind, this is 1843, but they will be allied together in order to keep Russia from conquering the world. Remember Mitt Romney saying, you know, the most existential threat to the United States is Russia? This is why. Because he thinks he's the white horse. And then during this time, the great white horse will have gathered strength, sending out elders to get the honest in heart of the United States to stand by the Constitution of the United States as it was given by inspiration of the Lord. Power will be given to the white horse to rebuke nations afar off. Now, who has that power? The president. The white horse becomes president. Not that they will be one with the white horse, but when the law goes forth, they will obey. Those opposing will be called Gog and Magog, the nations of the world led by the Russian Tsar, and their power will be great, but all opposition will be overcome, and this land will then be the Zion of our God, the United States. So Mitt Romney thinks he's running to be basically John the Baptist, the anointed one, who is going to anoint the Messiah when he comes back and save the world. Ted Cruz thinks the same thing. Here's Ted Cruz's father, Raphael. He said, for example, on August 26, 2012, he said, quote, he's talking about a previous pastor who was talking about Proverbs. He said, the pastor referred to Proverbs 13:22 a little while ago, which says that the wealth of the wicked is stored for the righteous. In other words, your wealth and my wealth, it's stored up for righteous people like the Koch brothers and Ted Cruz and his buddies. And it says that the kings anointed to take dominion, that transfer of wealth is going to occur. Here's Raphael Cruz.
It's an anointing as king.
Asking.
And God has given you an anointing to go to the battlefield. And what's the battlefield? The battlefield is the marketplace. To go to the marketplace and occupy the land. To go to the marketplace and take dominion. And if you recall, we talked about the fact that that dominion is not just in the church. That dominion is over every area. Society, education, government, economics.
All right. So rich people are going to rule America, and Ted Cruz is the guy who's going to make it all happen. That's the clip we have, right? Is there, there's another clip? Okay. The other clips, there's a few other clips out there. You can find them poking around, where Ted Cruz is anointed to be this guy, the king of the seven hills, who will bring this about. So Ted, you know, Raphael Cruz, the pastor who's the father, Ted Cruz's father, he's a Cuban immigrant, a Cuban, you know, refugee, as it were, although he actually left Cuba during the Batista regime and then went back briefly during Castro and then came back and set a pox on all their houses. I'm going to become a rich right-wing minister. And he did. And Ted went to the finest schools, Harvard, etc. Very smart guy, Ted Cruz. And therefore, I think very, very, he presents a very real possibility. He's already a major political mover and shaker in the United States. He's responsible for the shutdown of the government last year. And he seriously could run for president of the United States.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So which Republican messiah figure or pre-messiah do you want? Which John the Baptist, Ted Cruz or Mitt Romney? Your choice. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And get over to my call screen software here. And Adam watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Dry Ridge, Kentucky. Thanks for watching us on satellite TV there. Adam, what's up?
Well, Tom, I just recently found your program on Free Speech TV, and, you know, everything that's going on with this whole immigration humanitarian crisis,
right.
You seem to be the only person who really talks about what's causing this problem. And I remember yesterday you were saying how there was no other, you know, media outlet talking about what goes on down there in those countries. And today I finally found an article about that in NBC. But what worried me was, like, if you read the comments, you know, that people leave after the article,
right.
It's just, it blows my mind how, I don't know, like, how unsensitive.
Hello? Adam? Adam, your cell phone or whatever it is just faded out there for a second. So you said it blows my mind, and then I lost what you were saying.
That how unsensitive people are, and you read that people, like a lot of, I guess, conservatives, they say, oh, this is just a sad, sob story that the media is trying to tell us that to make us think that we need to take these kids in.
Right.
And it's just, man, it's like they have no compassion at all.
Has nobody noticed that these are not Mexican kids? I mean, Mexico is the country immediately to our south. These are kids from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. They have to travel nearly 1,000 miles through Mexico to get here.
Oh, I know. And they say, oh, the Mexicans, they don't care or do nothing. And like you said, they have 10 times the amount of refugees coming into their country.
Right. So. And plus, they have a lot fewer resources to deal with them.
Oh, yeah. And there was a quote, and you might want to look at that NBC thing. They have this whole, like, work up on the whole thing. This today was on there, like a 64 article deal. But there
was over on the NBC website,
that,
you mean?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
But there was a quote that said, if this was happening in any other country, the United States would be putting pressure, say if it was, you know, Syrian refugees fleeing to Turkey, we'd be putting pressure on Turkey to say, look, this is your obligation to take care.
We actually already are. And there are, you know, about 500,000 Syrian refugees in Turkey right now. But, you know, here's one that would make it even more clear. If Germany started, or maybe not, you know, Germany might be too hard for Americans to imagine. So let's take, you know, one of the smaller, you know, more unstable countries in attached to Europe. Let's say Latvia or Poland. Or Lithuania, if one of these countries elected, you know, some crazy guy who was mobbed up and part of, you know, the drug industry, and there's a huge heroin trade in Europe and a substantial mafia, and they put him in charge, and the death squad started killing white kids, Lithuanian white kids, who were then trying to get into Germany and France and Spain and Italy, we would be saying to those European countries, take those, and we would be probably intervening. I mean, you know, it's like we have a history of that, right? But here we're saying, oh, yeah, these Hispanics down there in South America, Central America, you know, so, you know, Reagan started the problem. But, hey, it's not my problem. It's pretty amazing. Adam, thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. I'll have to check out the NBC coverage on that. It's good to see that some network somewhere is starting to point out that if this was just people trying to come to the United States, because we're such a great place, they'd be Mexicans because they're next door. And instead, these are not Mexican children. These are Honduran, Guatemalan, and El Salvadorian children because of Ollie North. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here on radio and television stations all across the country and around the world. On Alternet, there's an interesting piece Mike Papantonio wrote. Actually, Pap's going to be on our program in the next hour, isn't he? Yeah. I'll wait on that. I'll wait until he shows up. Here, this over at the Huffington Post, Molly Riley writing, House Republicans just requested $3.3 million, to run their committee on Benghazi. They're going to spend more investigating Benghazi than they are spending trying to fix the Veterans Administration. Does that tell you something about the priority of Republicans? Okay, I mentioned earlier the Financial Times. I found this fascinating. Camilla Hall in New York writing for today's Financial Times. This is on the front page. Bankers warn over rising U.S. business lending. Now, you would think that business lending would be a good thing. Because it would mean the businesses are growing, right? Hey, there's a little factory in South Carolina that's making socks, and they need to, you know, there's so much demand for their stockings that they're adding, you know, another machine and three new employees, and they just needed to get a little bridge loan to till they ramp up that production to pay off the loan. And that's, I mean, this is how businesses grow, using debt. So you would think the business lending would be a, you know, increases in business lending would be a good thing. Not so much. And this goes to the financialization of our economy, how our economy has gotten stupid, and why that's dangerous for all of us. Camilla Hall writes for the Financial Times today over, you can read this at FT.com. U.S. lending to businesses is reaching record levels, but banks are privately warning. This is why I love the Financial Times. It's and no, they don't pay me anything to say this. In fact, I pay them for a subscription. But you get to read rich people talking to rich people. It used to be that way was the Wall Street Journal. I used to talk, you know, the first, those of you who have been listening to this program for the last 10 years, you know, the first 5-6 years of our program, I used to quote the Wall Street Journal all the time. They were the ones who pointed out that Dollar Bill McGuire had made over $1.7 billion as the CEO of UnitedHealthcare. But then they got sold. You know, the Blanchard family, I think was the name of it, or Bancroft family, whatever it was. It started with a B. They sold the Wall Street Journal to Rupert Murdoch, and since then it's basically just been Fox News. The Wall Street Journal, in my opinion, has become relatively worthless. It's the place where Sarah Palin publishes op-eds. But the Financial Times has kind of stepped into that space. And in fact, the Financial Times now has a larger readership in the United States than they do in Europe, even though it's a UK-based publication. But now they have a US-based staff and a US edition. And so if you want to know what the rich people are saying to the rich people, here it is. And, you know, rich investors. I mean, this was why I was reading the Financial Times back in 2006. That I read about how, you know, housing starts had dropped 30% in, I think it was the third quarter of 2006. And I came on the air and I said, look out, the stock market's going to crash. And for the whole next year, you know, as those of you who've been longtime listeners know, I said, you know, I'm getting out of the stock market to the extent that I was in it. And you should too. Actually, I didn't say, and you should too, because I don't do investment advice. But I said, I'm out of the stock market. And for a whole year, people were calling up going, hey, I just made $900 today in the market. Hey, I just made $9,000 today in the market. Hey, the market just hit 13,000. Hey, it just hit 14,000 to Dow. You idiot. You should have. And I'm like, yeah, maybe I'm wrong. And in fact, we had an advertiser that was a mortgage company that was doing these liar loans. And we stopped, you know, running their ads. I said, I'm not going to voice your ads anymore. So, and you know, I got rather roundly criticized for that by the radio station that was carrying them. This was the local show, actually, on KPOJ in Portland. But the point is that I'd seen this movie before because, by coincidence, in 2006, I was reading a book about the crash of 1929 and how it really started in 27 when housing starts and the real estate bubble burst down in Florida. And then that contagion, you know, it spread contagiously to the banking markets and to the stock market. Well, anyhow, back to the Financial Times. I had read that article in the Financial Times, as I recall. It might have been the Wall Street Journal back then. It was one or the other. Anyhow, U.S. lending to businesses is reaching record levels, but banks are privately warning that the activity should not be seen as evidence of an economic recovery. Much of the corporate lending, Camilla Hall says, remember I told you you want corporate lending because you want that sock factory to be buying a new machine and hiring three new guys? Not so much here. Much of that corporate lending is going to fund payouts to shareholders, finance acquisitions, and fuel the domestic energy boom, bankers say, rather than to support companies' organic growth. And then she quotes a senior banking executive at one of the large U.S. banks who wanted to speak anonymously. He said, loan growth doesn't seem to be driven by the underpinning of an economic recovery in terms of new warehouses and capital expenditure. You don't see the foundation of the real strong demand. And then she points out this has risen to $1.7 trillion private lending to companies in America. That's $1,700 billion from a post-crisis trough of $1.2 trillion nearly 4 years ago. Top 25 commercial banks by assets. Commercial and investment lending grew by 10.5% just in the quarter to June 25th from the previous quarter. When you see a 10% increase in lending in a quarter, 40% a year, 40% annualized rate, you know we are in a bubble. And the Financial Times, I believe it was, in fact, had an article, I think it was Friday, I think it was the 4th of July. It was either the Financial Times or the New York Times. The article had a headline to the effect of prices are super high in all asset classes. They were looking at everything from art to the stock market and saying all this stuff is overvalued relative to what it should be worth. In other words, we're in another friggin' bubble, just like in 2007 and 2008. Just like in 1999. Just like in 1993. Just like in 1986, 87. Ever since Reagan dropped the top tax rate, we have gone from having a relatively stable economy from 1935 until 1983. Reagan dropped the top tax rate, and we have been, now we're in a bubble and bust economy. It's that simple.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The exact same thing that happened when Warren Harding in 1921 dropped the top rate from 91% down to 25%. Bubble up right up to 1929, then it popped. Omnipotently ugly, the good. Stephanie Miller, during an appearance on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday, the Progressive Talk radio host slammed former Republican Senate candidate Carly Fiorina for defending the Republican line on Hobby Lobby and birth control, which, by the way, it turns out Eden Foods, the organic food company, was supporting. I used to buy Eden Food products. End of that one. Anyhow, Fiorina's degree in medieval history, Stephanie Miller said, probably comes in handy when she tries to explain GOP opposition to birth control.
By the way, I respect you as a woman very much in your accomplishments. I even read that you studied medieval history, which I think will come in handy when trying to defend the Republicans and their war
coming.
On women. But, Candy, every woman I know is furious about the Hobby Lobby decision. 98% of Catholic women use birth control. This is not just a war against
and
women.
They have
this is
16 forms
this
of
is
it.
A, this is a war against science, Carly, because...
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Because these religious, people believe certain drugs cause abortion. Doctors and scientists say they do not. So they actually prevent implantation. They prevent abortion.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Good on you, Stephanie, for bringing a cold, hard dose of reality to the Sunday talk shows. The bad, Nick Reed, the conservative California pastor, has put himself in the running for Hypocrite of the Week with his tweets about people protesting outside a Burbank, California Hobby Lobby store. After encountering the protesters on Friday, Reed sent out a tweet calling them bigots. He said one protester's sign says, "No bigotry in Burbank." Aren't they being a bigot by protesting a company that is exercising their belief? This, of course, is coming from a guy who said that the Bible makes it okay to discriminate against gay people. Go figure. And the very, very ugly coal rollers. Anti-environmentalist conservatives have found a new and totally disgusting way to show off their hatred for all things green. They call it coal rolling, and it involves modifying and then driving your car or truck in such a way that you can inject oil into the engine, into the combustion chamber, so that it shoots clouds of black smoke into the air or even at nearby cars. Anti-environment types say that coal rolling is all about protesting plans to cut carbon emissions. You can find videos online of it real easy. Some show coal rollers shooting their smoke at so-called Prius-driving socialists. If that's what modern conservatives call protesting, then that's really disturbing and very, very ugly. One last thing I wanted to point out, and then I'm going to pick up your phone calls. It being summer, it's also kind of anything goes summer, but we've covered a lot of territory, and the board is full of calls. We will get to you in just a second. But I want to talk to you about Congressman Andy Harris. In fact, I'd like you to consider possibly even calling Congressman Andy Harris. One of his local offices. Oh, this is the fax number that's high. Oh, here's the phone number. The phone number is 443-944-8624. I'll say that again in a few minutes. But you can also just call the main switchboard for Congress. I used to have that number written on my sheet in front of me. Do you know what it is, Shane or Jim? We used to have that on a piece of paper in here, the main number for Congress. Anyhow, there's a main number for Congress you can call, and you can just ask for any member of Congress. And it's over at callcongress.org. We've got it on our own website. And just ask for Andy Harris's office. What's the deal with this guy? Andy Harris He wants to become the head of the Republican Study Committee, which is like the most right-wing Tea Party of the right-wing Tea Party in the House of Representatives. He's a doctor, an anesthesiologist. He gets most of his money. His top donors are all in the medical industries, with the exception of Koch Industries, which is also, you know, Koch Industries is also in the medical industry, among other things. And he's the guy who's saying, yeah, the city of D.C. passed marijuana decriminalization. And it was passed and it was signed by the mayor, but it has to be approved by Congress. And so I am going to step forward as a member of Congress and say, no, you can't. Really? Andy Harris? Really? You can call Andy Harris. You can call any member of Congress, for that matter, at 202-225-3121. 202-225-3121. And just leave that up there for a while, Daniel. So he says that this is interesting. The in this piece at Washingtonian.com, the question, why is this Maryland congressman trying to undo D.C.'s marijuana decriminalization? The subhead says Representative Andy Harris says he's worried about teenagers' health. He's also gunning for a House leadership job. But, you know, Lee Fong pointed out this week in an article, I believe, in The Nation, that Patrick Kennedy and all these other guys who are running around going, don't decriminalize pot. It's a terrible thing to do. Think of the teenagers. Oh, my God. They're all funded by these big drug companies who are selling things like OxyContin, which kills hundreds of people a year. Nobody's ever died from pot. So these big pharmaceutical companies are funding the anti-pot movement, and they're funding Andy Harris, Congressman Andy Harris, who is trying to say to those of us who live in Washington, D.C., sorry, buddy. You know, I know your city council approved it. I know that your mayor signed it. I know it was the will of the people. They elected those city council men and women. But screw you. I'm the congressman from Maryland, and I'm going to tell you in D.C. how you got to live. Andy Harris's number is 202-225-3121. And I'm just wondering, you know, where does this guy get off thinking that he should run Washington, D.C.? Shouldn't D.C. run itself? His statement, let's see, Harris's press, Andy Harris. He said, passing a marijuana decriminalization bill for teenagers is not the way to lower D.C.'s shamefully high rate of drug abuse among teenagers. Actually, it is. If you decriminalize pot, then kids don't have to, I mean, ultimately you'd want to legalize it so the kids don't have to go to drug dealers to get pot. They can go to the local pot shop. I mean, when you show up at the local liquor store, you don't find a heroin dealer standing in the back saying, hey, you like that? I got something even better. Anyhow, 75% of the people convicted of a single count of marijuana possession in D.C. last year were given probation. But that means 25% of them were given jail time. That's nuts. And then you look at where this guy, he's a multimillionaire. His wealth is somewhere south of $3.6 million. Assets somewhere south of $3.9. His top five contributors. The American Interventional Pain Physicians, yeah. We don't want people to smoke pot. Pot is actually effective against a lot of different kinds of pain, particularly neuropathies. We want them to come to us so we can give them opiates. The American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, Koch Industries, is number three contributor. This is from opensecrets.org, by the way. American College of Radiology and Emergent Biosolutions, which is a global specialty pharmaceutical company. For the 2013-2014 campaign committee and leadership, healthcare professionals gave him over $250,000, Andy Harris. Don't you find it weird that all these guys who are against decriminalizing pot like Andy Harris, actually the question I'd ask him is, why are you taking money from the drug industry and the medical industries that are opposed to marijuana decriminalization? It's not even legalization here in D.C. It's just decriminalization. It becomes a parking ticket. It becomes a $25 fine. So it basically encourages police to stop putting mostly minority kids in jail. So if you're curious and you want to know Andy Harris's position, Congressman Andy Harris, the guy from Maryland who thinks that he should tell D.C. how it should run itself, his number is 202-225-3121, and ask for Congressman Andy Harris. Hope in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Hope, you wanted to talk about Ted Cruz?
Yeah. Well, I am just flabbergasted at everyone who says that he could be the next president. Isn't he from Canada? Why are we not saying, yes, he could be the next president, but he's from Canada, so that we can stop this at the cross?
Well, here's the deal. His mother was American. His father was Cuban. He was born in Canada, but he was born of an American mother. And Republicans are now saying that qualifies you as a natural-born citizen under the Constitution. It only doesn't qualify you if you happen to be black. This was a big deal for Barack Obama. You know, when they said, oh, yeah, he was actually born in Kenya. Well, Ted Cruz was actually born in Canada. They're both outside the United States. It's only a big deal if you're talking about a black candidate. If you're talking about a white guy like Ted Cruz, no problem. There are no Republicans talking about this. No hysteria around it. Drum Corsi's not blogging about it. WorldNet Daily's not all over it. In fact, they're supporting, to the best of my knowledge, the Ted Cruz candidacy because he's the Tea Party guy.
Wow. Yeah. I just think that we give credibility to that argument when we keep acting like he's a serious contender.
Well, he is a serious contender.
That's what they do.
No, he actually is a serious contender, and he could be president. There have been five presidents before whose parents were not born in the United States. And, you know, so this whole natural-born citizen thing was just a canard. It was put up. Drum Corsi wrote the book. And we had him on the program, and I debated this with him, and then WorldNet Daily took this, you know, viral, and the whole birther thing just went nuts. And it was really just a meta story. It was a way of saying without saying, hey, have you noticed that guy in the White House? He looks different than you know, most Americans. He looks different than the white people. And it was just a way of making him the other, making him different. That was what it was all about. Because now when a white guy is running, and he is seriously running, and there's a, you know, and John McCain wasn't born in the United States either. He was born in Panama, although both of his parents were citizens. But, you know, when it's a white Republican, it doesn't matter. Hope, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, do you want Ted Cruz Messiah, or do you want Mitt Romney Messiah? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Jesse in Miami, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, I wish Scotty could beam Cruz and Romney back to the Stone Age.
Well, maybe he could beam them to whatever place in heaven that they think that they will ultimately end up having dominion over. You know, according to Mitt Romney's religion, he will end up, you know, having his own planet that he will be the king of. And, you know, Ted Cruz's religion and his father say that he will end up being in charge of, including the economy, everything on Earth. I guess that's Earth. That's here. So Ted Cruz would have to be beamed here. That's not good.
Yeah. No, God help us.
Yeah, literally.
Hey, congratulations on that award you got about 2 weeks ago. And thank you for your service to you and your crew.
Well, thank you, Jesse. Thank you for your kind words. And it was a real honor to win the Freedom of Speech Award from Talkers Magazine. Thank you very much.
You really earned it.
Thank you, Jesse.
But you and investigative report needs to go a step further, because the 1% have played their cards. They,
yeah.
You know what they're doing with the money. It's pretty
oh, yeah.
much shaping up to the green versus the blue, money versus democracy.
Yeah, or so, money versus the earth, really. I mean, at
really,
the end of the day,
yeah.
There's a piece over on America Blog right now that Gaius Publius wrote, saying our carbon budget is now zero. We can't burn any more carbon if we don't want to destroy the planet. And,
yeah.
You know, nobody is even seriously talking about this. So, yeah, green versus blue. If blue is like, you know, the planet as seen from outer space, you see the oceans. Jesse, you got to move along. Thank you for the call. Thanks for your kind words. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing, man?
I'm great. How are you, Carl?
I am wonderful. Thanks for asking. I can always depend on the racist Republican base to be, well, the racist Republican base.
They have a way of doing that, don't they?
Yeah, they do have a way, and you know, they have a way of doing that and never letting me down.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons why I don't think that Ted Cruz would even get the nomination. For one, he's a Canadian, and they know that. And two, he's Hispanic.
Well, he gave up his Canadian citizenship, and he doesn't have brown skin. He's a white-skinned Hispanic.
Yeah.
So he traces his lineage back to Spain rather than to Mexico or South America or South or Central America. So right. I think that for the average racist, that puts him in a different category.
No, the average racist, they'll hear Cruz. Never underestimate the ignorance of America. I was talking of Americans. I was talking to a guy the other, just yesterday, a good businessman, and we were doing business, and we were talking political, and he didn't realize that most of the people on the plane that crashed to the buildings were from Saudi Arabia. This is an intelligent man.
Yeah, 17 out of the 19 hijackers. You'll never hear about that on Fox News, though, because the second largest stockholder in Fox News and News Corp that owns Fox News
Saudi Arabia.
Is a Saudi Arabian prince, right? Prince Talal bin Alawid, or however you say it.
Right. So never ever. You know, Fox is ironic that Fox is the Mecca for people who hate Mecca, and they don't realize that someone from that area of the world is owned a big piece of that company.
I know. It's very bizarre.
Even though he traces his lineage to Spain and not to South America, they still hear the name Cruz.
I don't think so, Carl. I think if his name was Garcia, he'd have a problem. But I don't think Cruz is... I don't think most Americans identify Cruz. I mean, they think of Tom Cruise. You know, they don't think of it as necessarily a Hispanic name. Carl, respectfully, I disagree. We'll see where it goes, though. Thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the Reverend D. Alexander Bullock, Pastor Bullock, is back with us. He is the founder and national spokesperson for the Change Agent Consortium, Action CAC. You can find it over at Facebook, facebook.com/ActionCAC. And his Twitter is D. Alexander B, or at ActionCAC. And Pastor Bullock, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Tom. Good to be on the program today.
Thanks for joining us. I thought this was a fascinating topic, and thanks for joining us about this. There was a newspaper, and I don't have it right in front of me. You're going to have to remind me where it was. And
West Village News.
Okay, and what state was that out of?
Out of New York.
Oh, out of New York City. Okay.
Yeah.
And they published an editorial that talked about the N-word, and they used the N-word. They spelled it out. In the White House, and it was actually kind of a pro-Obama op-ed decrying the racism that's being directed against Obama, but it was a white guy who wrote it, a white guy who published it, and they're using the N-word in the headline. And then there was a black guy who wrote an op-ed that they put on the same page right below it, saying, the headline above offends me. And you had a take on this. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, just initially appalled, almost saddened and shocked at the same time. We've tried to do so much work in the African-American community to get folks to stop using the N-word, both within the community, definitely outside the community. And so to see this as a headline, the N in the White House, really, I think, set us back. Why use a racial slur to characterize the president, even if it is to present a mirror of the racism that still exists in America? Maybe just use that as the title. Racism still exists in America.
Or what about a headline that says the N-word, N-W-O-R-D, in quotes, in the White House?
Or that as well. I agree. I think here you have good intentions, but going bad.
Yeah.
To characterize the first African-American president in any way, for whatever reason, using the N-word, I think is just inappropriate and sets us back.
Yeah, I agree. And in fact, I was pleased to see that a lot of newspapers that did stories about this story, when they reproduced a photograph of that page, blurred out everything after the N in the N-word. Increasingly in our culture, that word is kind of falling into the category as the F-word or the S-word or, you know, and there are similar racial slurs against other ethnic groups that, although they don't, and appropriately, I think, they don't carry the visceral force that the N-word does, because the N-word really was part of the tradition of slavery. It was the otherization of people of color and then the use of that to literally kill them, to you know, own them, to buy and sell them.
No, that's right. I mean, look, when you think about the N-word, you're thinking about lynching. You're thinking about separate and unequal. You're thinking about slavery. You're thinking about segregation. And I understand why someone would want to bring attention to the fact that the president is seen as an outsider. African-Americans still have to contend with institutional racism and race prejudice in America. But I think using a racial slur to try to move us past racism is bad strategy at best, and it is ignorant at its worst.
Right.
And we just can't tolerate anything that's going to set us back. We've made so many gains in this country. We don't want to set the tone or make anyone think that it is ever appropriate to call the president or any other African using the N-word in any way.
I would say the other group that we should respect at this level, but we don't, is Native Americans, because they suffered a genocide also. And the name of the Washington, D.C. team is pretty damn offensive, and increasingly people are refusing to use that word, and I think that that's a good thing. I opened this hour by talking about how Ted Cruz and Mitt Romney are both running for the Republican presidential nomination, or it appears that they are. And Ted Cruz's father has basically said that he's going to be John the Baptist. He's going to, you know, usher in the new age. And there's this white horse prophecy in Mormonism that suggests that Mitt Romney would be the John the Baptist, and, you know, a Mormon presidency would usher in the new age. And Mitt Romney kind of poo-pooed it himself on the campaign trail, but it still was a big deal in the Mormon community. And I mentioned this, and somebody called up and said, oh, how can Ted Cruz be running? He was born in Canada. His father's from Cuba. You know, he's not a natural-born citizen. And I said, that rule only applies to black people. That was just, you know, that Jerome Corsi and WorldNet Daily, that whole birther thing, and Donald Trump that ran for 4 years, that whole birther thing was really just a way of saying, hey, have you noticed that that guy in the White House is black? Holy cow, he's different than the rest of us. And I'm curious your thoughts on that. Because I said, I don't think it's going to apply to Ted Cruz. I don't think you're going to hear a peep out of the Republican Party.
No, I think you make a great point. It's amazing that, you know, if we talk about the N-word, we talk about being black, right, and you talk about slavery, black folks weren't persons. I mean, that's the history. Right. We're not a part of the original American democratic experiment. And so the talk about President Barack Obama, he's an outsider. Where's your birth certificate? Is he really an American? I mean, that's consistent with the myth of racism that has been perpetuated in this country. And of course, that has only applied to African Americans. It does not apply to others. So I think you've got the right read on that. And that's why in this context, continuing to resurrect these racial slurs just does not help us move past that, this kind of racial prejudice.
Yeah. Are you finding in the African American community that there is starting to be a substantial pushback against the use of the N-word?
Oh yeah. You know, it's amazing. Even the hip hop community is feeling the heat. You know, a number of entertainers use the N-word or some version of it in their music. You know, Nicki Minaj most recently had a picture of Malcolm X on the cover of one of her latest song on her new album. A lot of feedback saying, hey, take Malcolm X off of your album. How can you use the kind of language that you use and be connected to the civil rights movement? So we're finding that across the board, people do not want to see these racial slurs used at all.
You know, the one thing we didn't talk about is Detroit. I'm going to have to get you back. Pastor D. Alexander Bullock, he is leading some just amazing work in Detroit, and you need to get over to facebook.com/ActionCAC to see what that's all about. I'm sorry we ran out of time. Pastor Bullock, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be on the show.
Thank you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer. maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Just a reminder, Congressman Andy Harris, the guy who is trying to blow up D.C.'s, or maybe he's already done it, I don't know, who is blowing up D.C.'s marijuana decriminalization. He's not a congressman from marijuana. That would be Eleanor, or from marijuana, from Washington, D.C. That would be Eleanor Holmes Norton. He is instead from Maryland. And he gets money from the big drug companies and the doctors associated with them, as do most of the anti-pot people. His phone number is, or the number for Congress, for Congressman Andy Harris, if you're curious what he's all about, is 202-225-5311. There is a lot going on in the world, and this is another classic example of big money. You've got these companies that manufacture drugs that actually do, addictive drugs that actually kill people, these opiate drugs supporting members of Congress who are opposing marijuana. And the guy who knows more about that than anyone on earth is Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer and host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com. Pap, welcome back.
Tom, how are you?
I am great. I hope you are well.
Everything's great on this end.
So you've got a marvelous piece over Alternet. I strongly suggest people get over to alternet.org and read this. It's titled, Where's the Public Outrage About Big Money in Politics? You want to encapsulate that for us, and maybe you can answer that question. Where is the public outrage? Mm.
Well, first of all, we have to understand a little bit of the history. You know, you had great thinkers, people like yourself, Tom, Howard Zinn, Chalmers Johnson, Studs Terkel, that told us that that what we had to be aware of was money in the catastrophe of money in politics, but we had to be aware of it for another reason. They used to talk, if you remember, about colonialism, how we would go to third world countries and colonize. But they, by the end of their discussion, they were always talking about the idea that the colonialism also takes place by this new entity called the multinational corporation, and it's happening right here in the United States. They said, in order for it to happen, the most important component in America being colonized, not by another country, you understand, but by these new things called multi-conglomerates, corporations, is money. That was the most important, element to extract from us. If they wanted to extract from our labor resources, in pay pathetically low wages, their way to do that was to spread around enough money to bust unions, not just at a national level, but also in state and local level, right down to the counties.
Right.
They said if you want to extract from our natural resources through fracking and drilling and mining, then what you have to do, this new multinational corporation, the way they'll do that is they'll spread around money to the right regulators or the right local politicians. Most of that money would need to be pumped into this existing political system, since it's unlikely that a multinational corporation is going to march over here with an army. The multinational corporation doesn't even have a flag, much less a country or an army. So they're this ubiquitous thing that moves from place to place in the world, and the way that they're coming to America is by spreading around this big money. And they knew, in order to do that, they had to have people that were already here that would be their proponents. They had to have the Coors family in the Richard Mellon Scaife family, and they had to have the Koch brothers that had high political profiles that could make this happen. They could spread around money in the right way. And so this colonization that's taken place in America is very different from what we used to do to a third world country, but it's happening nonetheless. It's happening not just nationally, Tom. It's happening state by state, very methodically. And before you know it, we look around and we find out that we don't really have any rights where it comes to the to voting anymore. They've all been bought up.
Yeah.
And but this has been in the works for a long time, and it's not just my theory, and it's not this is something that was talked about early on by people like Chalmers Johnson and Howard Zinn, how we would be colonized without ever a shot being fired.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Many are continuing that tradition. And in fact, you know, a couple of quick examples. GE makes most of their money outside the United States. They do most of their business outside the United States. They typically don't pay U.S. taxes. And yet they're an American corporation that up until last year was the owner of one of the big three networks and, you know, kind of had their way here. You've got Walgreens. I don't know if you saw Robert Reich's blog. Walgreens has been acquired by Boots, a British company. But, they, you know, they're going to continue to do business in the United States. They just won't pay taxes here anymore. They'll pay them in the U.K. with a lower tax rate. And I'm sure that they'll continue to lobby here.
Well, doesn't that fit in exactly with what we're talking about here? These are just corporations that have looked at what's going on in other parts of the world, where you may have a corporation, a multi-conglomerate that is, they're housed in France, but they move all over the world. They don't have any allegiance to France. They don't fly the French flag.
Right.
So now we're seeing the reverse of that. We're seeing the American corporation that says, hey, I want to go to Switzerland. That's where Walgreens wants to go. So the real analysis comes down to this. If they're no longer an American citizen, if they're not a citizen anymore, why should we let them participate in the political agenda at all? Why should they be able to give any money in the political scheme?
Well, and if Shelley Adelson is making most of his money in China, you know, running casinos
right.
in Macau,
right.
how can he be giving that money to Newt Gingrich?
Well, that's exactly right. And it's more involved than that. Why do we allow government contracts to be paid to Walgreens now that they're going to be a Swiss company? Why do we allow them to be paid money through Medicaid and Medicare? Why do we allow any kind of government contracts to these countries that say, look, we're no longer an American company. We've joined the ranks of multi-conglomerates. We're in the extraction business as well. So here you have the you have this company that they use our military, they use our police, they use our roads and they use our streets, bridges. They use all of our infrastructure, but they pay no taxes. And so that passes on to us. It's somewhere, I think Robert wrote that it was somewhere around $2 trillion that we lose out of this scheme where these corporations
yeah.
that say, yeah, we want to live here. We want to be a member of the country club. We love the nice roads. We love the theater. We love the culture. We love all the nice things, but we don't want to pay taxes here. And we want to extract as much as we can from you in that process. So this process of, first of all, you have to really abandon this concept of thinking about this in terms of countries. There really is globalization that really removes that analysis. It's a fiction, really. It becomes a fiction. These entities, these new multi-conglomerates, these multinational conglomerates, they don't have a place that they live. And most importantly, Tom, the people that these multi-conglomerates rely on, these multinational conglomerates, people they rely on are these people like the Koch brothers who step by step are deregulating, step by step are busting up the unions, step by step are putting money into politics. And so when Chalmers Johnson and Zinn and any of these brilliant intellectuals were talking about this, they said this is where it's going to end. We'll be colonized. There won't be an invasion. Nobody's going to show up with a ship. We won't even know who the hell they are. All we'll know is that this dark money is creating this entity, this new entity. It's expanding this new entity called the multinational corporation. And because of that, we have cheap labor where they extract all of our natural resources
and leave a
mess in the process.
Yeah, and back in 1935, FDR got passed something called the Buy America Act, which is still on the books, which says that the government has to first source anything that they buy, and they're 20% of our GDP, anything that they buy from an American company. Reagan started issuing waivers to that, like there was no tomorrow, and every president since then has. But still, the government is supposed to buy American first. But if this new free trade deal with the Southern Hemisphere Asian Pacific countries, I call it the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA, S-H-A-F-T-A, the president calls it TPP. If this thing passes, then it explicitly says the Buy American Act is illegal.
Well, if you remember the Chamber of Commerce, they wanted that in there. The Chamber of Commerce, if you remember, since I think $65 million trying to defeat an effort that was being proposed by the American labor unions, and that was Buy America. You remember their big campaign, Buy America.
Right.
Well, you had the U.S. Chamber of Commerce come in and spend millions of dollars to try to defeat that effort, because there is no more Buy America. They think in terms of a globe now.
Yeah, it was a legislative effort to basically stop the executive branch from issuing waivers. Amazing stuff. Mike Papantonio, the attorney, America's lawyer. Mike Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com. Pap, thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Pap also has a show on Free Speech TV, Ring of Fire TV. Check that out at ringoffireradio.com as well. And welcome back to a beautiful sunny day here in D.C. Mike Papantonio is still with us live from Florida. I'm guessing it's probably a beautiful sunny day, too.
It is.
And,
great day down here.
So, Ring of Fire TV, what's coming up on the show this Sunday?
Well, we've got David Haynes right there from Washington, D.C., that's going to be talking about the tools that the SEC and Obama have to make inroads into the dark money movement in politics. Unfortunately, you got Mary Jo White, who's running the SEC, until she's fired, because she is nothing more than a corporate hack. Until she's fired, will make no meaningful inroads. She's single-handedly holding up what the SEC could do to end this dark money issue.
Is she an Obama appointee, or is she one of these holdovers from Bush?
Yes. She is, unfortunately. And it was lot of pressure from Wall Street. And that's who they wanted. They wanted this trollish little character that would give them everything they wanted, and that's what they got. Abby Martin's going to be here. Of course, you know Abby Martin from she's the host of Breaking the Set on RT America. Brilliant, brilliant young lady. She's going to be talking about Blackwater's criminal history and all the subparts of that. I've got Howard Nations that's going to be talking about how you're more likely to be killed by a right-wing terrorist in the United States than you are Al-Qaeda, and why we have failed. The benefit we could have by categorizing these right-wing terrorists, because we could do things like rendition, you could throw them in Gitmo, you know, no speedy trial. If we would treat them the same way we do with what we call the Mideastern terrorists that we've got this mental block about. Chauncey DeVega is going to talk about the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision and how there's more coming that's going to really bite the Supreme Court before it's all over with. We've got Frank Schaefer is going to be with us. I mean, brilliant writer. He's going to be talking about why is the American church dying? He's going to talk about the analysis of why the American church is dying, why young people are not moving into the church. So we've got an interesting program lined up, Tom, and I think we're going to be talking about those things that you talk about, but those things that you don't hear corporate media talk about. One thing we try to do on Ring of Fire Radio and Ring of Fire TV is to talk about the backstory, because the backstory is never given any time.
Yeah, the story behind the story, as it were.
Yes.
And Free Speech TV does such a great job of publicizing that. We have about a minute left. Is there anything else you wanted to go off on or share?
Well, I just think people need to understand what's happening with this. Tomorrow, this story that David Haynes is going to be talking about, tomorrow we could have the SEC require that corporations disclose who they're giving money to. Now, think about it. You're a shareholder, and you say, I have a political angst about you giving money to a guy like Mitch McConnell. Well, okay, you as a shareholder, you should have the right to understand that you may be one of those shareholders that only invest into publicly responsible companies, you see. Mm-hmm. And so you have a right to do that if it's disclosed to you that if Pfizer is giving money to Mitch McConnell and you don't want to do that, then you have the right to say, well, I don't want to invest in Pfizer anymore. SEC could do that tomorrow. Mary Jo White could do it tomorrow. She's made it very clear she's nothing more than a corporate troll in the truest sense. She is nothing more than a corporate hack.
Yeah.
And the unfortunate thing is Obama could get rid of her tomorrow, and for some reason he won't do that.
SEC being the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yes.
There you go. Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer, host of Ring of Fire Radio and Ring of Fire TV right here on Free Speech TV. Pap, it's always great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you. Blacks are arrested 8 times as frequently as whites for marijuana use, yet they use the same amount of marijuana, actually a little less, than white people do. Why are they arrested eight times as frequently? Well, because they're black. I mean, you know, it's like the whole stop and frisk thing. It's all about, hey, that guy looks like he might be a criminal. How do you know? Well, look at the color of his skin. Look at the neighborhood he lives in. He's got to be using drugs. Actually, drug use is lower in the black ghettos, if you want to call them that, the inner city areas, whatever Paul Ryan would call them. It's drug use is lower in those areas than it is in the white suburbs. But African Americans are eight times more likely to be arrested for drug use. And so Washington, D.C. said enough. You know, we've sent enough of our young African American men to prison. We're not going to do it anymore. It's going to be a $25 fine for smoking. We're not going to decriminalize it. We're not going to open pot stores next to the White House. There's not going to be a pot dispensary in the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, you know, which would be the one, you know, or maybe there's a, or in the Smithsonian, what do you call it? The greenhouse, the giant greenhouse. Yeah, the botanical garden. Thank you, Jim. I mean, that would be the perfect place, right? They have the botanical garden here in Washington, D.C., growing, you know, well, here's, you know, cannabis indica, cannabis americanus or whatever. Yeah, I don't know the different, you know, the genus species, but there's a whole bunch of different ones, right? Of pot and someday, I'm guessing over at the Botanical Garden, they do have hops, you know, to make beer. They probably do have grapes to make wine. And, you know, it'd be kind of cool if they had pot growing there. I remember going to Michigan State University back in the mid-60s. And there was a botanical garden at MSU, and in that botanical garden, they had a pot plant, and it was labeled marijuana. Or actually, it had the botanical name. And typically, about half the leaves were gone. And finally, toward the late 60s, like 69, 70, something like that, they just dug it up and took it away. No longer there. That was hysterical. Louise and I, you know, we were just talking about this like a week ago. This is when we were first dating, when we were young teenagers. Louise was living at home, and I was living out in East Lansing, and we were both under 17 or under 18. And her dad was prosecuting. He was the assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan. He was prosecuting the Licavoli crime family, and so they had. And she was living at home, and they had 24-hour state police protection because there had been death threats against her father for prosecuting the mob. And so when she snuck out at night for us to go out and have fun, she had to not only sneak out of her house, but she had to sneak past the state police, which was wild times. Wow. It's just like, it wasn't Beaver Cleaver, I guess, but it was close. I mean, it was a nice little house with a white picket fence, the whole thing. Anyway. So here in D.C., we said, the citizens of D.C. said to the city council, you know, yeah, those of you who ran on decriminalizing pot, not legalizing it, not setting up, you know, stores in the gift shop at the Smithsonian greenhouse thing, the Smithsonian Arboretum. What was the word again, Jim? Botanical garden. Thank you. Not that, but instead, we're just going to say we're not going to send our children to prison anymore. And Congressman Andy Harris, who isn't even from D.C., says,
"Well, I'm a doctor, and I get a lot of money from doctors and drug companies, and I don't like pot being even close to decriminalized, so I'm going to reject this."
Really, Andy? His Maryland office is 443-944-8624. 443-944-8624. Or you can call his D.C. office at 202-225-5311. 202-225-5311. And just, I realize that you probably didn't give a lot of money to Andy Harris's campaign. You know, he got $250,000 from the health industry. The quote healthcare industry, I would call it the sickness industry. Last year, according to OpenSecrets.org, but you know, as a citizen, the First Amendment gives you the right to petition your representatives. I mean, that's, you know, the Supreme Court is saying, you know, money is all about, money is speech and the First Amendment and all this. But if you read the First Amendment, it's really, you know, it actually gives you the right to call your member of Congress. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. So while you can, you know, if you harass the president of your health insurance, your for-profit health insurance company enough, you could be arrested for harassing them. Or if you stand out in front of their building, you can be arrested for being on private property. But if you call Congressman Andy Harris at 202-225-5311 and say something like, why are you taking drug company money and then trying to keep pot as a felony in Washington, D.C. so that more kids are going to go to prison and have their lives destroyed? Why are you doing that? What kind of hypocrisy is this? That's perfectly legal. In fact, that is exactly what the founders envisioned that an active and interested citizenry would do in the United States. I don't get what's going on with this guy, other than that he apparently wants to be the chairman of the Republican Study Committee. This guy, Brendan Williams Keefe, who is the chief of staff of another member of Congress, says that Andy Harris is trying to whip up his own campaign to take over the Republican Study Committee. Great. So some guy wants more power and wants more money from the drug industry, a drug industry that is addicting and killing thousands of Americans every year. So he's going to keep as a felony a drug which has never, ever killed any Americans. Congressman Andy Harris, Hypocrite of the Week.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can call Congressman Harris at 202-225-5311. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you over, over at Twitter. We've been tweeting about some of this stuff here, and Gracie says, Tom Hartman, Tom, you to be a natural-born citizen, you have to be born in the U.S. regardless of where your parents are born. Ted Cruz isn't a natural-born citizen. So were any presidents not born in the United States? Well, technically, yes. George Washington was born in a colony of the United Kingdom, as was John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and James Monroe. John Quincy Adams was apparently not born in the United States. I'm guessing that meant he was born before the American, before the Constitution was passed. Andrew Jackson, Benjamin Harrison, and most historians figure that Chester Arthur, was actually, his parents lived in Canada when he was born, although they said that he was born in Vermont. Nobody's really sure. But, you know, respectfully, the Constitution simply says you have to be a natural-born citizen. It doesn't say what that means. So it basically means whatever, you know, Congress or y'all decide it means. And Nat Tayat tweets, hey, Tom, did you know that the nearest botanical relative of marijuana is hops? Take a close look at a hops leaf, you'll see. Yes, not only did I know that, but I had some friends back in the 60s who would, I'm forgetting which way it was. I'm pretty sure that what it was you start a marijuana plant and you get it growing fairly well, and then you cut off the top and you graft, and you grow a hops plant, and you graft the hops onto the pot root, and the hops ends up, the hops leaves end up full of THC, and you can smoke them and get high. I might be misremembering. It might have been, it doesn't make any sense it would be the other way around, though, because the whole point was to have a plant that didn't look like pot, you know. But, yes, I know that. And actually, you know, the hops has its own psychoactive ingredients called lupulin, and because the botanical name for hops is Humulus lupus. And lupulin, it's actually after the Latin word for wolf. Canis lupus is the Latin name for a wolf, genus species for a wolf. And, you know, hops has a really interesting history. in European folklore and medicine. But they used to make pillows out of hops to put you to sleep. Lupulin is a hypnotic. If you take large quantities of it, and you can buy hops extract, and it gets you not slightly high, more like slightly tired. It's a hypnotic. And you find in a lot of the health food remedies that help you sleep, you'll find as an ingredient hops extract. Or sometimes they'll even label it as lupulin. But usually it's just hops extract. Because there's a whole bunch of other chemicals in hops, too, that act to kind of make you tired. So, anyhow, Mike in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Mike, thanks for listening to the mic. What's up?
You bet. Well, thanks for the number. I just called Congressman Harris's office and let them know I was calling from Wisconsin and told them they were on the wrong side of health and history and they didn't want to hear too much more. Sounds like they were probably getting more than just my call. But that's how things get done. We find that out, you know, and I live in a state where our governor isn't around much, so you have to take advantage of any politician within range.
To speak to you, mean
Washington.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good on you, Mike, for being an activist and for making that call. Thank you. Speaking as a resident of Washington D.C., I just think it's wrong. I think it's wrong that the young people in this town are facing. I had a friend when I was 17 years old. There was about five of us who hung out together in junior high school, and one of us got busted for pot, and he got a prison sentence. He was in prison. He got a 2-year prison sentence. He spent about a year in prison, as I recall. And I remember when he came back, he was broken. He was a completely different. He was like 19 years old. He was a completely different person, and just broken. And I, you know, we are killing our children by criminalizing a weed that grows in this, you know, anywhere in this country. It's just nuts. And nobody in history has ever died from pot. People die, you know, 50,000 people a year die from alcohol. You got 1,000 people or more a year who are dying, you know, many thousands, actually. I think it's OxyContin itself is over 1,000. And there's all these other addictive opioid drugs that you know, from the pharmaceutical companies and the doctors who prescribe them, who are big supporters of Andy Harris, that actually do kill Americans. Oh, but the pharmaceutical companies, they're sacrosanct. Can't have pot, though. Well, and D.C. isn't even proposing dispensaries. I mean, today is the day it went on sale in Washington State. And it's been going on in Colorado for a year. And maybe one or two people get high and do stupid things, but hey, how many people do that with alcohol every single day? David. In Victorville, California. Hey, David, you wanted to get back to immigration and the kids?
Yes. You know, Tom, I'm listening to you, and I just totally enjoyed the exchange you had with Mike. And oddly enough, the topics and the things that you were discussing were the things that was, you know, just rushing through my head as I was listening to the, you know, to you two share with one another. And it has to do with our foreign policy and our economic policies as it relates to immigration, coming home to roots.
Mm-hmm.
Our economic policies have been in South America and pretty much throughout the world, this colonial economic power that have been exercised over all of these countries. And so now what is occurring now, in all of these countries in South America,
Central America,
they have constitutions and governments and so forth and so on. But these governments are the prophecy, if you will, of what is going to happen to the United States, where you have oligarchs and death squads and militaries governing these countries in the majority of these people.
Certainly right now in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, yeah.
Yes, sir. And so now when you see these people coming to the United States, and then you see the American people who I think instinctively know that it's something really foul here in River City. And so when you see them in Marietta, I hope you give me a couple of seconds here.
Sure.
Because you also mentioned this thing about divide and conquer, and you also
was sharing with Mike about, they don't have any armies. They do have armies. They have the death squads. They have our military. They have our police. This has already occurred.
Sure.
And it just so happens that the blacks and the people of South America are the canary in the mine, so to speak, of what's to come for this, all Americans' rights, for this, what we are, you know, discuss about our Constitution. Like I said before, all of these countries have very beautiful constitutions and things on their law books that's supposed to guarantee their citizens rights and due process and this, that, and the other. But it has been co-opted as ours is being co-opted. So if we stop with this business of when we see our brothers and sisters in the streets trying to stop buses and label them racist, right, and begin this process of them racist and this tribal divide and conquer insanity to which they use at the most sophisticated level. When I say them, I mean the power elites, and we know who they are. And I would submit to you, Tom, that you and Mike are not anomalies for this Caucasians are concerned. And I think as you become more enlightened and as to what the actual deal is here in, and that's happening to America, this is going to happen to the vast majority of white America, because it does not have any.
Yeah.
This power elite.
David,
color, tribe, or race, or none of this other nonsense.
Yeah. David, if I may, and let me do a reality check with you on this. It seems to me that, you know, white Americans, by virtue in large part of white privilege, enjoyed the majority of the post-World War II boom and the, quote, middle class, right? After the mid-60s, a lot of African-Americans or some African-Americans got brought along on the ride, but it was mostly white Americans. And so it's been mostly white Americans since Reaganomics was put into place who have been kicked out of a place that they once occupied and that they expected, as you know, as a consequence of white privilege, that they expected they would always occupy. And so they're furious, and thus the Tea Party. These are people who are saying, hey, wait a minute, what happened to my country? I thought that I would have the ability to, you know, my children would have a better life than me, and what's going on? And so there's this basic kind of white rage that is showing up as populism, both on the Tea Party side and on the kind of Elizabeth Warren left, but particularly in the Tea Party. Your thoughts? David?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it makes sense, but now I'm understand. Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. Yeah. Their white so-called privilege, them white people being one who have benefited from this divide and conquer.
Right. Now that it's being used on them, they're freaking out.
But you see, the point being is that that was just a tactic.
Yep.
To use white privilege to do the divide and conquer. And that's what I mean when I say the blacks and the people from South America are like
the canary in the mine. In the mine, yeah. No, I'm with you. David, very trenchant observation. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be back with news from Talk Radio News Service. Bob Ney will be with us. Stick with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if you'd like to let Andy Harris know what you think about decriminalizing pot in D.C., whatever you may think about, 202-225-5311. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Barbara, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network in Dover, Delaware. Hey, Barbara, what's on your mind today? Barbara? I think Barbara is listening to her television instead of her telephone. Let's try Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, watching TV, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Well, I want to say that saying that we were in a bubble in 99 is somewhat misleading. The economy was actually strong then. GDP numbers and job creation was strong. The only thing that happened was a few internet stocks had a correction.
Well, yes and no. Wages were steadily declining during that period, Paul, or either flat or declining.
Actually, they weren't, Tom. Wages were being raised substantially, basically the whole time Clinton was...
Not above the level of inflation. Look at a graphic from 78 to today of wages. Yep. If you're talking about household wages, yes, they were going up. If you're talking about, because more and more people were becoming 1.1, 1.2, 1.3 person, you know, families. In other words, you know, mom was going to work or the kids were going to work or whatever, or people were taking a second job. But if you look at individual wages, they've been flat since 78.
Look at the chart that you've shown on your show many times. And if you go into that from 93 to 2000, wages rose substantially. And that was the only time during that 30-year period that they did rise. But anyway.
But I would say that was the function of a bubble.
No, that wasn't a bubble. The economy was strong. We had a surplus.
If it wasn't a bubble, why did it burst?
23 million jobs. What happened was Bush's policies of debt, wars, they destroyed the economy. But that doesn't mean we were in a bubble before that. If you have a brand new car and you let your neighbor take it out for a spin and he totals it, that doesn't mean there was something wrong with it beforehand. Of course, he's going to tell you, oh, they had some scratches on it and, you know, it wasn't running right. But,
you know, there may be a middle ground between our positions here. And because I would submit to you that ever since Reaganomics became the dominant economic philosophy in the United States, which has not changed since 82, where we set aside the economic policies of Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, and we went with Reaganomics. Ever since then, and ever since the top tax rate has been below 50%, I believe we have been in a cycle of boom and bust, boom and bust, boom and bust. And one version, one iteration of that was the tech stocks. That was followed by the housing bubble. Now we're seeing a bubble in corporate income and in the Dow, which we were seeing before along with housing.
We don't have a housing bubble right now either, because
we do in many parts of the country.
The housing bubble was created because there were millions of mortgages that people had absolutely no prayer of ever paying back, and that's not the case now.
Well, it depends on where you go. No, I think that was only a small piece of it. I think that there was this just general asset inflation. Right now, houses in Washington D.C. sell on average in 10 days. You can't say that of most other places in the country, but this city is awash in lobbyist money, and so there's a bubble going on. But is that's what you called about, right?
Well, yeah, but in 99 there was no bubble. It was a few internet stocks had a correction, and I know the right wingers always say, oh, that was a crash, because they want to blame a crash on a Democrat, because there's never been a crash under a Democrat, because the Republicans' policies are the ones that create bubbles and crashes.
Okay.
We had a strong economy until it was obvious that Bush was going to be president. And Alan Greenspan jacked up interest rates to 7%, slow things down, so that Bush could become president.
Yeah, may well be. I mean, Greenspan always said his job, his principal job, was to maintain a certain minimum level of worker insecurity. Thank you, Paul. Ten minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And with us on the line, former Republican member of the U.S. House of Representatives, Congressman Bob Ney, now reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, and the author of the brilliant book, You Want to Know How Washington, D.C. Works? Buy and read this book, Sideswiped. Bob, welcome.
Thank you, Tom.
And by the way, happy birthday. I know it was earlier in the week, but happy birthday.
That's one I'm trying to forget, but thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. So, going off on Congressman Andy Harris here. He's apparently hell-bent on blowing up D.C.'s decriminalization of pot. Do you know him? Any thoughts on that, or shall I just move along?
I don't know him.
Okay. All right. Well, let's just move along. What's going on in the news today?
Well, you've got the facts of immigration, and then you have the drama of immigration. But, it's famous now, Rick Perry has not greeted the president on the tarmac, but wants to talk about the issues. And then there's a controversy of should the president went, to the detention centers. But the fact remains the president introduced a bill, well, a request today, I should say, into Congress for over $2.7 billion. Now, it has morphed from when the White House said it would be for a two-path, which one was for the legal proceedings, et cetera, with the judges. And the other path was the screening and fast-track deportation. Because that language is not included in that, the Republicans are going to go nuclear today in the Congress over this and say, you see, he really doesn't want to deport them.
Right. Is this going to happen in the House or the Senate or both?
The House. Well, the Senate's going to do, they've got half of them for election, so they're going to make some hay on it, but the House will really just go crazy with this and probably pass something that demands that he use a portion of the money for fast track and deportation. But what's out there, Tom, is starting to...
You're talking about, pardon me, Bob, when you say fast track, you're talking about fast tracking immigrants out of the country. You're not talking about setting up the TPP.
Right. Oh, yes, okay. Yes, fast tracking out of the country.
Right, okay.
So that
pardon my interrupting you, but I just... Okay.
Yes, well, fast track also means the trade bill, sure, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. But fast tracking them out of the country. But the 2008 bill, which was voice voted and signed by George Bush... That little tidbit, which has been unnoticed, is starting to leak out because in 2008 there was a voice vote, which is when a bill has no one opposing it,
right.
Passed with Republican support, obviously.
The House and the Senate. And this was a bill that was sold as a bill to stop child sex trafficking.
Yes, they wouldn't have to go back to the pimps, et cetera, and face all kinds of problems.
Right.
And it set up a screening process. So that's where we currently are under. Now, if you really look, though, at the charts about, the immigration, and if you look at the charts about the fact of, where we've been, the facts remain that the Obama administration, if you look at the years, there were 4,000 unaccompanied children were apprehended, and that's up around... towards fiscal year 2012. In 2012, the number jumped to 10,000 apprehended, and then it shot up to 20,000 apprehended. And the vice president actually made it clear in Central America, we were not making it easier. We were apprehending people.
Right.
Just more people have come across the borders because the drug cartels are charging people and making some money out of it, and others.
And you've got death squads running around, El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala, the legacy of Ollie North and his efforts down there,
and
killing people.
Trying to get out of there. So this doesn't mean the president's not going to fast-track deport people that are, possibly, criminals or something. But I will tell you, the Republicans won't budge on immigration, yet they still have to do something with this. They cannot deny the president the money. Based on the fact that he doesn't have the language.
So if they pass legislation saying, okay, here's the money, but you have to quickly start deporting these kids, and that language is contrary or contradicts the bill that was passed in the last year of the Bush administration that was set up so that if for example, the police busted a brothel and they found a bunch of 15-year-olds from... typically from an Asian country or from a Central American, South American country, or sometimes from Eastern Europe, and they found 15-year-old girls, 14-year-old girls, sometimes younger than that. The law said that they would immediately be put in the least restrictive setting, in other words, a foster home rather than a jail, that they would be given an attorney, a guardian ad litem, who would represent their interests, and that they would have some sort of essentially refugee status rather than being dumped back with the pimps who had brought them here. Or rather than being deported where the pimps could capture them. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong on this. That's the legislation that is colliding with this. How does the president deal with that if there are two pieces of colliding, not just competing, but colliding, contradictory legislation passed?
Well,
or does that go to the courts?
You're 100% right in the way you described it. And the Republicans completely, by voice vote, passed it, and George Bush signed it. So with the two collisions here, at some point in time, the president is going to have legislation. And, of course, they're not going to pass legislation in the House because they have the Eric Cantor lost effect, I call it, where they believe somehow that he lost over immigration, which he didn't.
Right.
But they believe that. And so it's just going to sit. They'll jump onto Benghazi in August and let the rest of this sit.
Well, Congress has spent more money investigating Benghazi than they've spent looking into what's going on with the VA. I mean, it's getting bizarre here. Bob.
Well, it is. And then Gowdy, Congressman Gowdy, has actually been reaching out on a courtesy basis, to the ranking member, Elijah Cummings, who, of course, Congressman Issa made the, cut the mic off,
right,
pointing to his own throat type of, statements. And so it makes you wonder if, in fact, Congressman Gowdy is trying to find some mutual things they can agree that need tweaked. Maybe they don't have the silver bullet.
Well, Trey Gowdy is the guy who's running the Benghazi committee, but Darrell Issa is continuing to try to do Benghazi under his committee, and which is where ISA is the ranking member, or the minority member, or whatever it's called. And so maybe this is just Trey Gowdy trying to say, hey, help me put this crazy ISA on the sidelines, do you think?
Well, they would like to have him on the sideline, and Speaker Boehner won't step in and actually just tell him to stop. He tried through Gowdy, but now,
Well, I think Boehner's afraid of him. I mean, ISA is one of the few guys in the House who can fund his own campaigns.
That's true.
He's worth $700 million. I mean, he's independent of Boehner's pack. Mm-hmm. Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. The book is Sideswipes. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And about, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years ago, it was while, in the time that we've been doing this show, the Lyndon Johnson, the LBJ Library, released a bunch of tapes that had been held for years and years, and we didn't know were there, and I was digging through them, and I discovered that in 1968, in the summer of 1968, according to these tapes, so these are tapes of Lyndon Johnson talking on the phone, LBJ had negotiated a peace in South Vietnam that was going to be announced in September or October of 68, which would have helped his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, beat Richard Nixon for president, and also would have ended the Vietnam War. And the Nixon campaign had found out about it, and John Mitchell and a few other people in the Nixon campaign operating out of New Mexico had actually contacted Madam Tu and others in the South Vietnamese government and said, we will give you a better deal. And LBJ had the CIA tape recordings of these people doing, committing this treason. And I've been for years on this program, I've been playing this tape for you over and over and over again, where LBJ calls up Everett Dirksen, the senior Republican in the United States Senate, and one of the probably most high integrity Republicans in my lifetime, and says, Everett, this is treason. But we can't let it get into the media. We can't let America know that Richard Nixon is committing treason to try to become president. And here is that recording.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
And there's a whole series of conversations around this. And, we've been talking about this for years in this program, but nobody has really picked it up. And now there's more to the story. And Robert Perry, the founder and editor of Consortium News, author of America's Stolen Narrative, consortiumnews.com, has done some brilliant writing on this thing. There's some new documents coming to light. And one of his piece, An Insider's View of Nixon's Treason. Robert Perry, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So what's new on this story?
Well, the latest piece of new information actually comes from the Nixon Library. There was an oral history that was done with Tom Houston. Now, Tom Houston was a national security aide to Richard Nixon, who was perhaps best known for his so-called Houston plan, which was to expand spying on the anti-war movement in the late 1960s and early 1970s. But before that, at the very beginning of the Nixon administration, Nixon assigned Houston to investigate what Johnson did know about the failures of those peace talks in Paris. And basically, Nixon had been informed by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover after the election, when he was president-elect, that Johnson had these tapes that mostly were FBI tapes, actually, where they'd been taps placed on the South Vietnamese embassy and on apparently on one of Nixon's operatives, Anna Chenault, and that this information had led Johnson to know that Nixon had tried to sabotage the peace talks. So Houston was assigned essentially to try to reconstruct what the Johnson people knew.
Yeah, it actually, Robert, it goes a step beyond that, because from the Johnson Library, LBJ is begging Everett Dirksen to do something. Dirksen calls him back and says, I talked to Nixon. He's going to call you. And Nixon calls LBJ.
Nixon did call. Yes.
And says, I'm not doing this.
Right. Nixon denied. There was a subsequent call to the one you played from Dirksen, where there is, it's a remarkable conversation where Nixon is talking to Johnson, trying to convince Johnson that he's innocent. Johnson's playing it very close to the vest, but making it clear that he has information. But
right.
Nixon doesn't learn the details of Johnson's knowledge until Hoover informs him after the election. And then, so Nixon becomes concerned, obviously, as to what has happened.
Is this what they were looking for at Watergate?
Well, it's a good question. Basically, what we now know is that, and there's also, I also found at the LBJ Library a few, couple years ago, which is part of the book America's Stolen Narrative, this file. There was an actual file which Johnson did not include in the official material that was taken after his presidency to the library. He entrusted it to Walt Rostow, his national security advisor, apparently to keep it out of the hands of Nixon. And so what that file was, that file contained the top secret wiretaps of what they knew about Nixon's operation, and it was quite detailed.
Whoa.
And Johnson had Rostow take it and hold it until after Johnson's death, and it was then eventually turned over to the Johnson Library, and 20 years later or so, they began declassifying parts of it. So we now have it, and it does show a remarkable amount of information that the Johnson folks had as to how Nixon did it, why he did it, who the players were in it. There was still some uncertainty that the Johnson people had, but the point of the new material from Houston is that Nixon was trying to locate what the Johnson folks had, where it was, and this leads ultimately to that remarkable conversation from the Nixon tapes on June 17th of 1971. It was after the Pentagon Papers had begun to come out. Nixon knew something the rest of us didn't, that there was a sequel to the Pentagon Papers. The Pentagon Papers end about 67. What Nixon was afraid of is that that there would be another disclosure from these other documents that were missing. They couldn't find them, that would reveal that Nixon had engaged in this, what Johnson called treason. And obviously that would have had a huge impact potentially on Nixon's political future.
Right.
In 71, there was a very angry anti-war movement out there. Nixon certainly would have faced demands for impeachment possibly, or certainly would have endangered his reelection in 72. So he sets up, at that point, he sets up the plumbers. And he orders them to break into Brookings because he believes that these documents might be hidden in the Brookings safe.
And Brookings is where the Pentagon Papers had come out of.
Well, not really, but they were from the Rand Corporation.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, thank you.
But Nixon thought this file, because Houston had told him he believed that this file might be in the safe at Brookings. Nixon then puts together this team under E. Howard Hunt to go break into Brookings. The break-in apparently failed, but the team was set up, and it became the plumber unit that broke into Watergate a year later.
Right. Amazing. So we have just a minute. Robert Perry left, consortiumnews.com. Robert, we know that now also that the You know, the Bonnie Sauter wrote last year in the Christian Science Monitor, the president of Iran, that they had cut a deal with the Reagan campaign to hold the hostages. So Reagan was not a legitimate president. He screwed Jimmy Carter by committing treason. Bush was not a legitimate president. Supreme Court gave him the presidency. Nixon committed treason. Has there been a legitimate Republican president since Dwight Eisenhower?
Well, obviously, the question you have to sort of ask, I suppose, is whether, for instance, say George H.W. Bush would have been in a position to win in '88 if it hadn't been for his being part of the Reagan administration.
Right.
And clearly, Reagan won overwhelmingly in '84. But certainly this is part of now the Republican DNA there to use these very anti-democratic tactics to achieve power. They understand the importance of power, especially controlling the U.S., and they do whatever they have to do to get it.
And this is why they do things like voter suppression.
Exactly.
Yeah. Amazing. Robert Perry, the founder and editor of Consortium News, a great news source. Consortium or consortiumnews.com, the website, at Consortium News, the Twitter, and the author of America's Stolen Narrative. Robert, you're doing great work. You're doing God's work. Thanks for being with
us. Tom.
Good talking to you. Always good talking to you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Be sure to check out Robert's writing over at consortiumnews.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Les in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin. Hey, Les, you are a former legislator from Colorado?
That is correct, Tom, and I actually recently retired, but I wanted to kind of give you some information about about Richard Nixon's war on drugs. And how the criminalization of marijuana came about.
Okay.
Richard Nixon was so concerned. He was actually terrified of the student demonstrations, largely against the war in Vietnam, that were threatening to bring down his presidency.
Right.
And so what the...
This was in 70-71. Right.
And so what the Watergate burglars and essentially his staff, this would be Colson, Ehrlichman, Haldeman, Dean, all those guys did, he said, how can I break the back of the student movement? So they studied the situation, and they came back to him, and they told him these paradigms of virtue and honesty, told Richard Nixon, if you criminalize marijuana, which is the soporific of choice, the drug of choice of the young people and the students, and literally send them to prison and really, really come down harshly on the young people, you will end and break the back of the student movement that is threatening to bring down your presidency. So they actually wrote the criminalization of marijuana legislation and presented it to Nixon, and he was later able to get it done. I just wanted people to know that two things. First of all, this is completely and totally politically motivated. Has nothing to do with medicine or the actual effects of cannabis. It was completely political. And it has, when I was a legislator, we wrote, in order to respond to Richard Nixon, we wrote the legislation to legalize it. And so that it could not be used as a political and social tool against liberal thinking young people. And what I can say is proudly, in 2012, we finally had the legislation passed in Colorado.
Right.
And of course, we're working on it in Washington State.
Right. Today was the first day.
Right. And the biggest problem we have is that if you're in Colorado and you go to the dispensaries, you will see that the DEA, the feds, are the ones who are continuously harassing the legal marijuana dispensaries. And this is why we are asking desperately for the federal government to reverse the criminalization of marijuana.
Right, there you go. And we could start with Andy Harris backing off on D.C. You can call his office through the congressional switchboard, 202-225-5311. Les, thanks a lot for the call. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And David in Woodland Hills, California. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Thank you, Tom. I've learned more from you than all of my teachers put together, and it doesn't cost me $60,000 a year tuition. Thank you, David. First of all, I have a slogan for you. Keep democracy alive. Recall the five.
Okay, who are the five?
The five Supreme Court justices.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, our little kings here, yes.
Keep democracy alive. Recall the five.
I'm with you.
I wonder if you read Harold Meyerson's article about time to dump the top two, no matter what party, playoff or recall or runoff system.
In California, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I believe I have. I've read several articles, particularly right after the last election, that were highly critical of, and a couple that were supportive of, this top two system. For people who don't know what we're talking about, you live in California. A friend of mine ran in that campaign, Marianne Williamson, for Henry Waxman's seat, and didn't rank in the top two, ultimately, unfortunately, in my opinion. But I think she'd make a great member of Congress. But, you know, she'll be back, I hope.
Me too.
But in any case, the way it works in California, unlike most states, is rather than the Republican Party having a primary and the Democratic Party having a primary, there's just basically this open primary, and anybody can jump into it, and whoever the top two vote getters are end up being on the ballot in November. And it could be two Democrats, and it was actually a couple of years ago, and you had two Democrats running against each other for a House seat, one of them won, and or it could be two Republicans, or it could be a Libertarian and an Independent. It could be anything. And so back
right.
to you, David.
What he said in this article is in a few heavily Democratic districts, you had six Democrats running, two Republicans. The Democrats split the vote. The two Republicans end up being the runoff.
Right.
So you'll have a Republican representative from these districts, which are heavily Democratic, because the Democrats
right.
split the vote.
Which, I don't think was the intent of the lawmakers when they passed this top two. They were looking for some way to break up the two-party duopoly. Or am I wrong? Was this actually something that the Republicans really, some real slick strategy on their part?
I think the Republicans were opposed to it, and the Democrats thought that most of the time they'd end up with the top two Democrats running.
Yeah.
And most of the time it does work that way, yeah. But sometimes you end up with this situation where the Democrats split the vote. And the Democratic Party could fix that by saying, hey, you bottom four guys, drop out.
Right, which is probably what the Republican Party does. I mean, that party enforces discipline really, really well.
Right.
Whereas, as Will Rogers said, I'm not a member of an organized political party. I'm a Democrat. it's like a Democratic Party is like herding cats. Excellent, excellent point, David. Is there an effort in California to dump the top two, or to go back to it, or to do what San Francisco's done and go to ranked voting?
How is ranked voting different?
Well, it allows you to that's a good question. It allows you to select your first choice, your second choice, your third choice, and if the first choice is not, one of the winners, then it's called instant runoff voting. I mean, it's an instant runoff. And San Francisco ended up with a green as a mayor as a consequence of this. I think that
I like that better, but I think you still could end up with two Republicans and the Democrats
splitting
the vote. I don't,
while you're talking about a primary, or maybe even in the national election. I mean, I think back to 2000. In 2000, I voted for Ralph Nader. My wife voted for Al Gore. We lived in Vermont, so we knew that. I knew that I could vote for Ralph Nader in Vermont. It would not have an impact
right.
on Al Gore's ability to get elected. Had I lived in Florida, I would have voted for Al Gore, but. And 4 years later, when David Cobb was the Green Party representative, I believe it was 4 years, it might have been 8 years later, David Cobb said, please vote strategically. If you're in a swing state, don't vote for me, vote for a Democrat, which I thought was just very noble, right? And the Green Party was, you know, that was pretty good. But with ranked voting, I could have said my first choice is Ralph Nader, my second choice is Al Gore, and my vote would have become an Al Gore vote, and you wouldn't have people running around saying, you know, that there were some, what was it, 7,000 or whatever the number of Green Party candidates who got votes down in Florida. It was much, much larger than the 500 and some odd vote margin that Bush supposedly won by. I mean, in the recount that the New York Times did, Gore won that election. But still, the claim was that Bush won it by 500 votes. There were a lot more than 500 people voted green. So in Florida, they could have voted for Ralph Nader and then said, but my second choice is Al Gore. And so when Nader didn't pick it up, those votes would have become Gore votes. And that seems to me like a more functional. I mean, you know, Australia's been doing this for a decade, two decades. New Zealand's been doing this for a while. And it seems to work well in those countries.
I agree. I think we should try that system instead of the other one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's that or it's proportional representation, which can be done at the state level in any state in the United States. Some states would have to amend their constitutions. Others would simply have to pass laws. But you don't have to amend the U.S. Constitution at proportional representation, which is where if a party gets 5% of the vote, they get 5% of the seats in the House or the Senate. If they get, you know, 30% of the vote, they get 30% of the seats. So, you know, lots of different ways to skin this particular cat. Dave, that's a horrible metaphor, isn't it? My apologies. David, thank you for the call. From David to David in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening at 9:50 a.m. David, you wanted to talk about this use of the N-word that we were talking about in the first hour with Reverend Bullock?
I do.
Go for it.
Okay, I think that, you know, I followed when the guy was talking about it. I think that an attempt to totally eradicate the word from the language is overboard. For starters, I mean, are you going to rewrite Mark Twain's classics and take that word out and substitute N-word?
Right. No, I don't think so. And I don't think there's an effort to completely eradicate it. It's to eradicate it from public discourse as opposed to private discourse.
I've got a black friend right here. We talked about this. If I were to call someone an uppity N-word, that would be just as offensive as using the other word. So it doesn't really help.
Yeah.
This N-word.
You know, I get what you're saying, David. I think that the argument that Pastor Bullock was making is that they're trying to expunge that even out of the black community, out of the African-American community. And you know, white people using it doesn't make it any easier or any better. David, we're out of time. Thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And David, thanks for listening to AM 950 in Minneapolis. We'll be back. Andy Harris's office, Congressman Aaron Andy Harris, 202-225-5311. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here at the place where we dare to ask, is Hobby Lobby a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. It's a corporation, for goodness sake. By the way, if you are calling Congressman Andy Harris's office at 202-225-5311, please be nice. This is, it's kind of the first principle of political discourse, of lobbying, of asserting your First Amendment right to petition your government for redress of grievances. And that is that you be nice, that you be polite. And the second really is that you stay to one topic. What you will find is when you call your member of Congress, any member of Congress, but, you know, I encourage you constantly to call your own member of Congress about whatever's on your mind. In other words, participate in your democracy in this republic. We live in a republic that is supposed to be interactive. Our nowhere in the Constitution does the word leader appear. Instead, the people who we elect and send to the House, the Senate, whether it's federal or local, state, whatever it may be, although the Constitution deals with federal offices, they are referred to as representatives. They are supposed to represent us. And so, as such, what you will find is that if, you know, they keep track of who calls and why and what they have to say. And if you try to do more than one topic, if you call up and say, "Yeah, I'm really upset that you're trying to stop the decriminalization of pot in D.C. And by the way, this Hobby Lobby or whatever, Benghazi." What you will find is that they won't be able to pass the info. They won't be able to check the little box and say, "Here's what that call was about." So you may want to call your members of Congress a couple of times during the course of the month, single topic each time. But be nice. The people answering the phone are, by and large, mostly their interns. Sometimes they're staffers. They're paid to answer the phone. They're not the member of Congress. It's extremely unlikely that Andy Harris is going to answer his phone. And so you're talking to somebody who's basically just trying to earn a paycheck and put, food on their family, as George Bush would say. So, treat them as a human being, please. Andy Harris, the guy who's trying to undo the will of the people, the citizens of Washington, D.C., who elected a city council that voted to decriminalize marijuana and elected a mayor who signed that legislation. But D.C. being a federal district, not having representation in Congress and not being autonomous, even though we have more people living in D.C. than in Vermont or in Oklahoma, I think more than Wyoming, maybe not Oklahoma. But, our population in D.C. is larger than several of the states or in the neighborhood of several of the states. But still, we don't have representation. And so we are at the D.C. residents, I'm one of them, are at the whims of Congress. And Andy Harris is the latest guy to try to build a political career on kicking D.C. upside the head. In this case, our decriminalization of pot. I think it's really tragic. And apparently he's trying to become head of the Republican Study Committee, this right-wing group within the right-wing group. And this is the card he's playing, according to the chief of staff of another member of Congress, according to this article over in the Washingtonian, Washingtonian.com. The article's headlined, "Why is this Maryland congressman trying to undo D.C.'s marijuana decriminalization?" ? Then if you go to opensecrets.org, you discover that, most all of his money is either coming from Koch Industries, which also has a hand in pharmaceuticals, or from people who make money selling drugs. Legal drugs. Legal, addictive, deadly drugs that kill people who don't want pot decriminalized, apparently. Cut into their profits? I don't know. But it seems pretty, I'm not sure I'd use the word corrupt, unseemly to me. But please be nice if you call Andy Harris's, Congressman Andrew Harris's office at 202-225-5311, or even his Maryland office, his home office, at area code 443-944-8624. Sharon in Lacyville, Pennsylvania, you want to get back to the conversation we were having earlier about why is it Republicans are not screaming that Ted Cruz is not a natural-born citizen?
I believe someone called in and said Cruz couldn't be president because he was born in Canada.
Right. He has renounced now, since his Canadian citizenship, and he used to hold two passports.
They said that about Obama when conservatives claimed he was born in Kenya.
Right.
So I actually went online and did the research to see what our laws say about who is a citizen.
Right.
And this is what it says. If one parent is an American citizen and the other parent is not, but they are legally married, then their kids are American citizens no matter where those kids are born.
Right, right. And the 14th Amendment amplifies that. It provides this so-called, born on American soil birthright or birthright citizenship. The question, though, the Constitution says that members of Congress must be citizens. It says that the president must be a natural-born citizen. Now, here's the problem. What natural-born means has never been clearly defined by the courts or by Congress. It's in the Constitution, but nobody has ever clearly defined exactly what it means. So when President Obama came along as part of the campaign, the right-wing campaign, to characterize him as somehow exotic, you'll recall John McCain using that word exotic, and others, on the right using that phrase as something different from the rest of us. Hawaii is weird enough, but maybe he was even born in Kenya as a, trying to carry. And this is, dog whistle racism, really. they went off on this whole birther thing. And I was sitting in the room with President Obama and his wife when he called out Donald Trump to his face on this at the correspondence dinner, the White House correspondence dinner, a couple back, about 2-3 years ago. And it was a sight to behold. It was the most hysterical thing. It was the day of or the day after he released his long-form birth certificate. But you're right. That is what the law says. And like I said, I think because Ted Cruz is perceived as a white guy, there's going to be very, very little conversation about this. Sharon, thanks a lot for the call. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi. First of all, in terms of the, in following up with the spirit of being nice to Representative Harris, I would recommend that.
I'm listening.
Hello, this is Gary.
Yeah. Gary?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Did I just dump a caller and go to you and not realize
he dumped another caller.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I pushed my chair back from the table a little bit and I must have hit the mouse. So whoever was on the phone before, call back and I'll put you on the air. My apologies. And Gary, it's off to you, I guess.
Yeah, I'm in D.C. and I just want to let you know I called the congressman's office just a few minutes ago and expressed my displeasure with him interfering with the decriminalization of marijuana in D.C.
What'd they say?
And expressed wishes of she listened and she said that she would pass the information on to the congressman. Mm-hmm. And I told her I hope she would.
Yeah.
And I was polite.
Good.
That's the main reason why I called in to let you know that I was polite.
Well, thank you very much, Gary. That's good. That's what we all have to do. It's so easy to express outrage, you know, but we don't want to become like the Tea Party or like these crazies out in California who are, you know, screaming obscenities at 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds who just came across the border from Honduras or Guatemala or El Salvador. Gary, thank you so much for the call and for being an activist in America. That's our job as as citizens of a democratic republic. It's our job to participate in politics. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
He meant all of that, Tom. Above average show, as always. You touched on a number of related issues today worthy of inclusion in my personal archive that I'm putting together to pass on to some of the neighborhood kids at some point so that they'll be able to refer back to it when they're adults having their own kids and it'll take on some kind of archival value of its own.
Well, thank you, John.
You're welcome, and you deserve that mention and that honor. You are what I call an upstanding American.
Well, thank you.
Okay, enough of this mutual admiration.
All right, let's move along.
One of your callers in an earlier hour, I think, unintentionally represented the activists that stopped those two buses filled with those frightened kids from Central America as something that was worthy. And I just wanted to point out in case he didn't, I apologize, but for those people out there who do monitor your program, mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, KPFT does use the voting system that you mentioned before, what do they call it? I forget, but it seems...
Instant runoff voting, ranked voting?
Sir?
Instant runoff voting or ranked voting?
That's what they call it, instant runoff.
IRV.
It saves time and expense from having to take multiple votes. You mm-hmm. do multiple voting one time. So
yep.
The computer takes care of that.
Agreed.
Anyway, I wanted to bring up the fact that when liberals, true blue Americans, stop a bus or a munitions train, it's for a noble purpose. And in the process of doing so, they often risk life and limb, as what happened to some liberals back during the Vietnam War.
Or the...
on the far right get in front of a bus, they do it to frighten kids or to serve their own interests, or they think... they're serving their own interest. That's a big difference.
Yeah, I think a good point, Johnny. Very, very good point. And though back, you know, back in the 60s and 70s and even the 80s, it was Catholic priests and nuns going to prison for trying to stop nuclear weapons from moving around the United States or stop the School of the Americas down in Georgia that was training the people who became the death squads that are operating right now in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador that are responsible to some extent for these children literally traveling 1,000 miles through Mexico to get to the United States. We'll be back, Mr. Palmer. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of your Your thoughts on the news of the day, my thoughts on your thoughts, my thoughts on the news. All that Reddit sticker. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And you have the audio of Cokie Roberts? Let me hear this. This is, I was talking about Obama being exotic, and Shane said,
but
no, it wasn't.
He has certainly come nowhere near closing the deal, as we've talked about before. In this year that should be such a Democratic year, given all the other indices, he is tied in the polls and stays tied in the polls. And going off this week to a vacation in Hawaii right. does not make any sense whatsoever. I know his grandmother lives in Hawaii, and I know Hawaii is a state. But it has the look of him going off to some sort of foreign exotic place. He should be in Myrtle Beach, and you know, if he's going to take a vacation at this.
Well, that's interesting. So she was talking about the optics of it, and this was what during the election of 2012. Oh, 2008. 2008, when he was running for president the first time. Wow. Interesting. Very interesting. Okay, Stephen. In Fort Worth, Texas. Hey, Stephen, you wanted to talk about the immigrant kids? You are in the state where many of them are showing up. Stephen, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV? No, Stephen. Okay. Let's see here. Jerry, listening to WBAI in New York City. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Very
you know, on the U.S. Supreme Court, you know how yesterday... You had a very smart caller by the name of Paul, and towards the end of his conversation with you, he was saying how, with respect to the four conservatives, or the, well, four conservatives and one libertarian, Kennedy, I regard as a libertarian, with respect to the conservatives on the Supreme Court, he was saying towards the end of his conversation with you, how with them it's all very personal and very political. Well, I agree, but I'd like to elaborate, and I'd like to say what I think is going on with these conservative justices on this nation's highest court. And what I think is going on has actually has nothing to do with the facts of the case or the specific legal arguments made. Instead, I continue to be convinced that with respect to at least four of the conservatives on this nation's highest court, Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito, I think in addition to them being conservatives and seemingly sexist Republicans, I think in addition to that, they are both definitely plutocratic and corporate Republicans who are predisposed and predetermined, in my opinion, to vote in both in favor of corporations, powerful corporations, and also they're predisposed and predetermined to vote in favor of wealthy individuals, no matter what the case is. And then it only becomes a question of whether or not they'll get Justice Anthony Kennedy, who I regard as the libertarian on the court, to go along with him, yeah. because he is basically conservative, but a libertarian.
Well, John Roberts was a corporate lawyer. I believe
yes.
Alito was a corporate lawyer. I believe Thomas was a corporate lawyer. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
I think Mike Papantonio once said on this program, who would know? I mean, he's a lawyer himself, and head of one of the lawyer associations, or at least was. I think he said that all five of them were formerly corporate lawyers, although I could be wrong in my
right.
memory of that.
Right, and that's why I think that we progressives should avoid wasting too much time analyzing and strategizing against the precise legal reasoning that these conservatives on our nation's highest court say they use to arrive at their plutocratic pro-corporate decisions. The reason they arrive at plutocratic pro-corporate decisions is because they're corporate.
No, they're starting with the endpoint in mind, and they're reverse engineering their decisions. I'm with you, Jerry. And we need to call that out. Thank you very much for listening to WBAI. We'll be back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Shane corrects me. Alito apparently was a prosecutor, which is why he's always on the side of the cops, right? I got nothing, no problem with police officers. I think that we don't pay our cops enough in this country. I'm probably the only talk show host who's actually a graduate of a police academy. But in any case. David in Chicago. David, you're the guy who was on the air when I tried to move my chair and bumped you off. I'm sorry.
Tom, don't move your chair, okay?
Yeah, I won't do it again.
Hey, first of all, in terms of being polite with Representative Harris, I think these news stores in Colorado and in Berkeley, they should all send gift certificates for marijuana to
to Representative Harris and his staff, especially those staffers who might be from Colorado or California, to be polite and nice. Maybe even drop off a gift box of brownies. Who knows? I think that would be a great way to...
Well, you can't. I would not advocate doing something illegal, and then the dropping off the gift box of brownies would be definitely illegal.
Doesn't that mean that they have to have a legal substance, but it could be symbolic of the...
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. Although, I can tell you here in D.C., I mean, you can't even mail things to members of Congress with the expectation that it'll take less than a couple of weeks to get there, because everything's got to be double and triple searched for, you know, ever since the anthrax thing.
Right, that's why you got to deliver it, because,
yeah.
But you get the point. Anyway, I wanted to, President Obama's asking for $2 billion on this whole southern border thing, and I think for this money to be effective, from what research I've done, is that we have to treat these illegal alien minors from Central America the same way that they're treated from Mexico and Canada, and that they're interviewed by the Border Patrol and then adjudicated that way, and then appropriately, you know, and humanely repatriated, and suspend foreign aid to these countries that won't take back the repatriation of their own citizens.
Well, I think it even goes beyond that, David. We should suspend foreign aid to countries that have repressive regimes that are basically narco-traffickers, which is what has happened in El Salvador and Honduras.
But what about Mexico? The whole senior government is corrupt in that regard.
Well, yeah, it is, but it nowhere near as bad as these countries directly to the south of Mexico.
Agreed. And I think the last thing is we should ensure if that $2 billion should be going to the Border Patrol and ICE, not for resettlement of all these people. There might be legitimate cases for the U visa to be employed here.
Right.
But
Here's the problem that the president has, David. The last few months of the Bush administration, Congress passed a law, and it was a voice vote in both the House and the Senate, so it's recorded as a unanimous vote. And they passed a law against child sex trafficking, and President Bush signed it into law. And I mean, I don't think anybody's going to say I'm in favor of child sex trafficking. So everybody was, you know, it was unanimous basically. And this law says, and the reason the law was passed was because there were some national busts, nationally publicized busts, that happened in a couple of states where they were busting mostly Korean massage parlors or prostitution rings that were bringing women over from Eastern European countries. And they were finding 15-year-olds and 14-year-olds and 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds, girls who, you know, not only, I mean, prostitution is illegal in the United States to begin with, but these were minors. And so they said, when a minor is caught who is not a citizen, is found in the United States, that minor has to, number one, go into the least restrictive setting available to them, which would be like foster homes, as opposed to children's jail, number one. And number two, they automatically have an attorney appointed to them, a guardian ad litem, to represent their interests. And number three, they have available to them a legal process through the courts by which they have some say, or their guardian has some say, their guardian ad litem, their guardian at law, their lawyer, has some say, ultimately, in where they end up. Because in some cases, these kids were literally sold by their families to criminal operations. In other cases, they were kidnapped. In other cases, you know, you don't want to give them back to the pimps. You don't want to drop them back on the streets in Brooklyn or wherever it may be, you know, Cleveland, Ohio or something. You don't want to send them back to the family if the family was responsible for their being here in the first place. I mean, you know, the stuff needs to be sorted out. And so children who come to this country illegally all by themselves without an adult have, as a consequence of this law that George Bush signed, have a very unique legal status that does not apply to other, you know, quote, illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants. And this is what is tying the Obama administration up in knots, as we've got this humanitarian crisis, these refugees coming from El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, who are escaping, in some cases, death squads, you know, narco traffickers, corrupt governments. And in other cases, they're simply, you know, the victims of drug cartels who used to, you know, who make money moving drugs into the United States.
Yep.
And now they're using those same smuggling lines to smuggle people into the United States, and they're charging the families thousands or tens of thousands of dollars to get these kids out of these hellacious environments. So, you know, the Obama administration, You know, and now we were talking with Bob Ney about this, and, you know, a former member of Congress, now he's a reporter, and he said, you know, the Republicans are not going to give Obama this money without some strings attached to it. And what I'm wondering is, how are they going to get past this child sex trafficking law? Are they going to try and strike it down? Are they going to amend it?
They have to pass legislation to address that.
That's correct.
But here's the thing is, why aren't these people being screened in the first place when they're coming into the country so that we don't end up with this mess?
Well, they are.
As an afterthought.
No, they are.
They aren't. No, they aren't. Because we're allowing in 1.2 to 1.5 million foreign legal workers, and 40% of illegal aliens come here legally and overstay their visa. So U.S. visit, that program for tracking, is broken.
Right. Certainly the last part of your statement is true. Over the last couple of years, we've actually seen more people leaving the country than coming into the country because the economy has been so bad. But, you know, I get your point. I get your point, David. And this is why, you know, the Senate passed comprehensive immigration reform. It was passed by Democrats and Republicans in the United States Senate. And they sent it to the House, and it would pass the House if Congressman John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, would simply put it on the floor for a vote. It would pass. It would only take 19 Republicans and all the Democrats, and it would pass. But Boehner will not put it out for a vote because that would be giving Obama even one tiny victory that could be attached to his legacy, and they're not going to do that. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.